It's a great pleasure to be back with you this morning, and again, in this exchange that Bob and I have been doing for several years now, and to bring you greetings from your UU colleagues in Napa and surrounding area in the North Bay. I've already read the Bellatini reading, but the sermon begins with another reading, in effect. This is from a book by Nick Tursa entitled Kill Anything That Moves. On the evening of March 15, 1968, members of the AmeriCal Division's Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 20th Infantry, were briefed by their commanding officer, Captain Ernest Medina, on a planned operation the next day in an area they knew as Pinkville. As unit member Harry Stanley recalled, Medina ordered us to kill everything in the village. Infantryman Salvatore La Martina remembered Medina's words only slightly differently. They were to kill everything that breathed. What stuck in artillery forward observer James Flynn's mind was a question one of the other soldiers asked: are we supposed to kill women and children? And Medina's reply: kill everything that moves. The next morning, the troops clambered aboard helicopters and were airlifted into what they thought would be a hot LZ, a landing zone where they'd be under hostile fire. As it happened, though, instead of finding Vietnamese adversaries spoiling for a fight, the Americans entered My Lai, encountering only civilians, women, children, and old men. Many were still cooking their breakfast rice. Nevertheless, Medina's orders were followed to a T. Soldiers of Charlie Company killed. They killed everything. They killed everything that moved. They gunned down old men sitting in their homes and children as they ran for cover. They tossed grenades into homes without even bothering to look inside. An officer grabbed a woman by the hair and shot her point blank with a pistol. A woman who came out of her home with a baby in her arms was shot down on the spot. As the tiny child hit the ground, another GI opened up on the infant with his M16 automatic rifle. Over 4 hours, members of Charlie Company methodically slaughtered more than 500 unarmed victims, killing some in ones and twos, others in small groups, and collecting many more in a drainage ditch that would become an infamous killing ground. They faced no opposition. They even took a quiet break to eat lunch in the midst of the carnage. Along the way, they also raped women and young girls, mutilated the dead, systematically burned homes, and fouled the area's drinking water. There were scores of witnesses on the ground and still more overhead. American officers and helicopter crewmen perfectly capable of seeing the growing piles of civilian bodies. Yet when the military released the first news of the assault, it was portrayed as a victory over a formidable enemy force. A legitimate battle in which 128 enemy troops were killed without the loss of a single American life. In a routine congratulatory telegram, General William Westmoreland, the commander of U.S. forces in Vietnam, lauded the, quote, heavy blows inflicted on the enemy. His protege, the commander of the AmeriCal Division, added a special note praising Charlie Company's aggressiveness. When news of the My Lai massacre became public knowledge, military leaders assured us that that horrific event was an exception, an aberration, the work of some bad apples. But subsequent investigative reporting revealed that far from being an exception, events like My Lai occurred dozens of times during the chaos that was the Vietnam War. Just a few weeks ago, couple months ago now, there were celebrations in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, remembering and reenacting the famous Civil War battle that was fought there on July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, 1863, just 150 years ago. Many skirmishes took place during those 3 days. We all learned in our American history classes about Pickett's famous last charge, in which thousands of Confederate soldiers attempted unsuccessfully to breach the Union lines. Here is a report of one of the smaller skirmishes in that battle. On July 1st, 1863, Alfred Iverson ordered his brigade of North Carolinians across an open field. The soldiers marched in tight formation until Union riflemen suddenly rose from behind a stone wall and opened fire. 500 rebels fell dead or wounded on a line as straight as a dress parade, Iverson reported. They nobly fought and died without a man running to the rear. No greater gallantry and heroism has been displayed during this war. Soldiers told a different story of being sprayed by the brains of men shot in front of them, or hugging the ground and waving white kerchiefs. An artilleryman described one row of 79 North Carolinians executed by a single volley, their dead feet perfectly aligned. The living rolled the dead into shallow trenches, hence the name Iverson's Pits, now a grassy expanse more visited by ghost hunters than battlefield tourists. I know that hearing these things is not pleasant, but we need to remember that war, at its heart, is an extraordinarily brutal and unpleasant event. The latest estimates are that 750,000 Americans died during the Civil War. Since today's population is 10 times what it was in 1861, in today's terms, that would mean 7.5 million dead. We were taught to believe that the Civil War was a good war because it led to the elimination of slavery, something Great Britain had done peacefully more than 40 years previously. But of course, as we know, black people did not begin to get their civil rights in many parts of our country until legislation that was passed in the early 1960s, 100 years after the Civil War. And 150 years after the Civil War, racism is far from dead in this land of the free. From another book about war, Niall Ferguson's The War of the World, the 100 years after 1900 were without question the bloodiest century in modern history, far more violent in relative as well as absolute terms than any previous era. Significantly larger percentages of the world's population were killed in the two world wars that dominated the century than had been killed in any previous conflict of comparable geopolitical magnitude. Although wars between great powers were more frequent in earlier centuries, the world wars were unparalleled in their severity, battle deaths per year, and concentration, battle deaths per nation year. By any measure, the Second World War was the greatest man-made catastrophe of all time. 55 million people died in that good war. And yet, for all the attention they have attracted from historians, the world wars were only two of many 20th century conflicts. Death tolls quite probably passed the million mark in more than a dozen others. There was not a single year between or after the world wars that did not see large-scale organized violence in one part of the world or another. And as this 21st century proceeds, there seems to be no diminution of violent conflict on our planet. News reports of people killed in one war or another have become so commonplace but they are relegated to inside pages of the newspaper, so the front pages can be devoted to news of the latest rock star or political scandal or a royal christening in England. In 2001, the United States spent $287 billion on the military. In 2011, 10 years later, the bill was over $700 billion, which was $250 billion more than was spent on Medicare that year. The United States spends more on wars, past, present, and future, than all the other countries in the world combined. We even now speak of clean wars, which seems to mean wars in which fewer of our own military people are likely to be killed. So, a technician sits in an air-conditioned room in Virginia, controlling a drone aircraft which looks down on people in some foreign country, and if those people are identified as terrorists, or even linked to terrorists, and have you ever stopped asking about that word linked that some of these people use so readily? What does being linked to a terrorist actually mean? If I happen to greet one on the street, would I be linked to that terrorist? Anyway, these people are identified as terrorists or linked. He fires a rocket from that drone, which eliminates, we never say kills, eliminates them. Since 2004, over 880 civilians and nearly 200 children have been killed by drone attacks in Pakistan. And we have learned lots of other euphemisms for our dirty work. Extraordinary rendition, capturing suspects and removing them to secret places where they may be questioned without much worry about the methods being used in the questioning. Collateral damage, which seems to mean, oops, we did not mean to kill you, sorry about that. Kinetic action simply means killing people. Enhanced interrogation, meaning, of course, torture. And in a recent speech, President Obama spoke of lethal targeted action. The predictions of George Orwell about our use of language have come true. So we continue to have and to tolerate what the Bible predicted, namely wars and rumors of wars. And why? Don't we all agree that killing people is bad, wrong, immoral? And make no mistake, the fundamental action of war is to kill people. Historians' work is to try to explain why wars happen. And they, of course, point to a number of reasons. Ethnic conflict, like we saw a few years ago in Yugoslavia, where Serbs and Croats and Bosnians were fighting each other. Another reason sometimes given is economic volatility. In the 1920s, as a result of the reparations that were required of them after the First World War, Germany was in dire economic peril. It permitted the rise of the Nazi power and eventually to the appointment of Adolf Hitler in 1933 as their chancellor. Empires in decline often provoke conflicts of one sort or another. At the beginning of the 20th century, there were at least a half a dozen empires, nations that controlled other lands and peoples. At the end of the 20th century, there was only one empire. But we didn't call it an empire, we call it a superpower. Religious differences have unfortunately often led to violent conflict. I like to remind people that 40 years ago, when you heard the word terrorist, you associated that with Ireland, where the Protestants and Catholics were fighting. Today, of course, it's between the Sunnis and the Shia, in Syria and Iraq and other places. Perhaps it was all the reasons for war were best summed up in a New Yorker cartoon. It shows sort of a medieval setting. A king is riding his horse, leading his army behind him, carrying their spears and shields. And in the crowd of soldiers following the king, one of them has obviously asked the other, "What is it we're fighting for this time?" And the other one replies, "I hear it's because we're right and they're wrong." Of course, virtually everyone justifies war by claiming defense. We do not actually choose or deliberately choose war. Rather, we are forced into it. We have no choice. We are attacked and we feel threatened, so we must fight. So on August 10th, 1949, some of us here were then alive, what had formerly in our government been known more correctly as the War Department became instead the Defense Department, one of whose major efforts, and they have been incredibly successful over the last 50 years, is to discover potential enemies against whom we need to defend ourselves. If we don't have any enemy, why do we have a defense department? Another word for defense, I suggest, is vengeance. And who would argue that that was not a motive in our invasion of Iraq in 2003? On January 17, 1961, in his farewell address to the nation, President Dwight Eisenhower warned his fellow Americans of becoming a nation caught in a perpetual state of war. "We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex," he said. "The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes." So what are we to make of this continued popularity of warfare? It would seem that the only conclusion is that we humans are a sorry lot indeed. That's the bad news. But a preacher is supposed to bring good news. The word gospel means good news. This sermon started out to be a screed about and against war. Not much good or even new about that. And then I came across a book by Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker entitled, from Lincoln's first inaugural address, "The Better Angels of Our Nature," subtitled, "Why Violence Has Declined." In that book, Pinker argues exhaustively, the book including notes is over 700 pages, but he argues that in the long 10,000-year history of human civilization, violent conflict has in fact declined. If you look at the statistics, it is true that the Second World War killed 55 million human beings, but the Mongol invasion of the 13th century probably killed something like 40 million humans when the world population was less than a tenth of what it is today, which means that today's equivalent would be to over 270 million deaths. Archaeological evidence seems to suggest that in prehistoric times, as many as 15% of humans met a violent death at the hands of another person. Today, the figure is much, much less than 1%. Many of Pinker's statistics are hard to believe at first because our media inundate us with news of violence. An old maxim in journalism is that if it bleeds, it leads. So murders make the front page. Pinker even calls the period from 1945 to the present the Long Peace, though during that period, despite a spate of small wars, There have been no major wars between big powers in the world, something that before 1945 occurred with some regularity. So the good news is that more and more people in the world are increasingly viewing warfare not as thrilling and glorious, but as wasteful and stupid. And surely we must stand up and be counted as enthusiastically supporting that view. So while none of us here is likely to see the end of warfare or even lesser forms of violent conflict, there is the possibility that the trend is positive toward more peaceful ways of resolving our differences. I used to tell students that of everything they heard and read, they should ask two questions. One was, why? But the other was, so what? War, popularity, so what? I suggest it speaks to the importance of what we hear, say, and do in this fellowship or church. We UUs are not a creedal church. That is, when you join this church, you are not required to say that you believe certain theological doctrines, like you do in most, if not all, Christian churches. Rather, we are a covenantal church. You join this group because certain values are important to you, and those values are summarized in the principles which we covenant, and which are printed, I think, in the back of your bulletin. One of our most important values is that we will not discriminate against any person on the basis of race or age or sexual orientation or gender or ethnic background or any other difference. But while we can agree to all of that, there is still one area which can at times be troubling for us. We like to use the phrase, and I think we spoke it earlier today, speak your own truth. Liberating and very noble, that sentiment. However, what happens when the truth that you speak disagrees with the truth that I speak? Some of us have strongly held opinions which differ radically from the equally strongly held opinions of others in our group. A fellowship like this, a church like this, is a kind of testing ground, you see, for how people who might be very different can still get along in some kind of peace and harmony. As some of you may have heard, up in Napa, we have just spent the first 2 months in a new church building that we were able to buy earlier this year. So you can imagine how some of the questions are about what do we do here and how do we arrange that and so on and so on. And there are lots of differences. So we're having lots of practice trying out this getting along with one another. Decisions are being made, and not everyone will agree with all those decisions. So what do we do? Well, deep in the animal recesses of our brains are impulses which our prehistoric ancestors learned were necessary to survive. When threatened by conflict, the answer was fight or flight. But we have, over the course of 10,000 years of evolutionary development, grown other parts of our brains, which means that it is not necessary for us to submit to those elemental instincts. We now have reason, which enables us to see that beyond those basic impulses for fight or flight, there is a third possibility: tolerate and accommodate. Now, what has all this to do with war? Warfare is simply the extreme expression of one way to deal with human differences. People go to war because they violently disagree with one another. But by demonstrating that fighting is neither a necessary nor useful nor constructive way to deal with differences, we here in this church have opportunity to reduce the time to that hallowed goal when fighting will cease and we will all live in peace.